Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC's Deputy Political Director Mary Alice Parks.
Mary Alice, I'm coming from an undisclosed location in the Washington area. We have, of course, been hit by a major blizzard. And you are here because I understand Rick Klein, was fired or is he just couldn't come in or what? Do you know what it was?
You know, I think Rick's on vacation and I'm the only one that could brave the snow.
Okay. Well, welcome here. It's great to have Mary Alice here. We've got a heck of a lot of political news. We've got a lot of news coming out of the White House. But Mary Alice, I sense that we're hitting kind of a critical point in the 2020 presidential election. And of course, the calendar tells me we're still in February of 2019.
It's crazy. We're still months from the first debate and a lot of campaigning still to go. And yet I'm looking at not one, not two, but multiple 2020 headlines from the last few days.
And one of the big ones is we see a new entrant. It seems like every other day we have a new entrant into the race. But Bernie Sanders has made it official. Bernie Sanders is running again. And I got to tell you, I was there when he announced the first time that he was running.
There in the Senate swamp,
there because,
that one?
Yes, I was there. But also, I don't know if you remember this, but his announcement was actually, he did it on ABC News, on Good Morning America. We pre-taped the interview with him the day before and then ran a little clip of it on GMA, and it was kind of like, it wasn't exactly huge political news because we all assumed that Bernie Sanders was some kind of a basically kind of a protest candidate or a guy to get his issue out there because it was just going to be the coronation of Hillary Clinton. He turned out to be the guy that dominated the Democratic primaries and got closer than anybody thought to actually winning.
Little did we know. But that's the biggest difference this go around. People know who Senator Sanders is. I mean, that changes the calculus a lot. The campaign strategy for Senator Sanders is going to have to look entirely different this go-around because it's not a matter of introducing himself to the country. It's now a matter of maybe changing people's mind about him.
And I would argue that, in a way, he's already won. This is a different Democratic Party than it was 4 years ago. He came in as this long shot, almost like somebody that nobody was really going to take seriously. And now the issue set that he ran on is the dominant issue set for many of the top tier candidates that he'll be competing against. Bernie Sanders may not ultimately win the Democratic nomination this time around either, but I think it's safe to say that he has set the terms for this primary.
Yeah, when you just go through that list, Medicare for all, aggressively fighting climate change, a $15 minimum wage, debt-free college. These were issues that Washington insiders and people in the Democratic Party thought were too extreme, too far left. And now you're exactly right. They're just mainstays of the party. You know, his people say that's why he is going to win this time, that the party has moved in his direction. But a lot of campaigning remains to be seen and done. Voters have a lot of decisions to make.
Of course, he is somebody who has been an independent for most of his political life, not a Democrat. He's also called himself a socialist, a democratic socialist. And I thought it was interesting what we heard from Kamala Harris this week when asked about that label.
The people of New Hampshire will tell me what's required to compete in New Hampshire, but I will tell you I am not a democratic socialist.
Yeah.
Okay, so she's not a democratic socialist. There was another moment this week that we had Amy Klobuchar, one of the others that recently got into the race. Amy Klobuchar did a town hall on CNN, and she was asked about another big Bernie Sanders issue, which is the idea of free college education. And this is what she had to say.
I am not for free four-year college for all. No. Thank you.
So let me ask you this, because
And I wish if I was a magic genie and could give that to everyone and we could afford it, I would. I'm just trying to find a mix of incentives and make sure kids that are in need, that's why I talked about expanding Pell Grants, can go to college and be able to afford it. Yeah. And that make sure that people that can afford it are able to pay.
Yeah, we're on a college campus, so you know many of the questions.
I know that.
Many
know
of the college
campuses. I've got to tell the truth.
That was an interesting moment, but look, other 2020 candidates have been right there with Bernie Sanders, saying free college education, Medicare for all, as you mentioned. You know, he has in many ways defined the debate. But here you saw two other, I would argue, top tier candidates, certainly Kamala Harris, rejecting the label, and Amy Klobuchar, who I think is going to be a real sleeper candidate in this primary, directly saying, you know, we have to talk about what's practical, not simply what we want.
Yeah, look, Bernie Sanders officially getting in means that some of these other candidates can now have a real life foil. They can draw a comparison. They can say they're bringing a different perspective, a female perspective, a diverse perspective, a more moderate perspective, perhaps, in the case of Amy Klobuchar. She's going to keep making an argument that she's a pragmatist, that gets things done, that understands the middle of the country there in Minnesota. But I have to say, it is tricky to run on pragmatism. I thought she sounded a lot like Hillary Clinton in that soundbite, talking about progressives being a little too high in the sky with their dreams. And that's not necessarily the way you inspire voters. It might be honest, but that's a hard campaign.
What's your read? Because you spent God knows how many miles and days and hours on the road with Bernie Sanders during that primary race as ABC's embedded reporter on that campaign. And you saw the way he ignited the passions of the Democratic primary electorate. What is your sense this time? Because I've heard two different theories. One, that Democratic primary voters want above all to win and to beat Donald Trump. And in that sense, perhaps a pragmatic view. They will support somebody who they believe will win, even if they don't fall in love. And then you hear the clear energy of the party is with the progressive left, and that's why you see so many of these top tier candidates, you know, rushing to take positions that will energize that part of the party. So which is it? Where is this primary going to be fought and won?
John, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think you're exactly right that Bernie Sanders has always been testing a political theory. That theory is that if people are excited and super inspired by big sweeping ideas, they're more likely to vote, and that new people would vote. People who haven't campaigned or knocked on doors before would do that too. And so he's still testing that theory. I think what's really important to remember is that for a lot of Bernie Sanders' base voters, he hasn't gone anywhere in the last 2 years. They see a guy who has been pushing Amazon and companies like Disney on minimum wage, who's been out there campaigning with these town halls and videos and still engaged in that level of grassroots organizing kind of behind the scenes over the last 2 years. And they are ready and engaged already and ready to step up and work for him. But there's a whole other sort of set of issues that aren't related to that progressive versus moderate spectrum that could still determine someone's electability. I mean, things like the fact that Bernie Sanders would be 79 years old in 2020, that he's white, that he's a guy, that he's run before and lost. There are a lot of Democratic voters that are looking for generational change, big diversity, and just something new.
So one of those things that we saw that energized Democrats and was seen as a generational change and a voice was the campaign of Beto O'Rourke against Ted Cruz in Texas. And of course, he lost, but did far better than you would expect a Democrat to do in a statewide race in Texas. But I want to ask you about a moment from the president's trip to Texas when he went to El Paso, and Beto O'Rourke had his event counter him, and it was an event that drew a lot of people, despite what the president may want to say. It drew a lot of people, a lot of energy. But then he had this exchange on MSNBC about the wall.
If you could, would you take the wall down now, here?
Yes.
Like you have a wall.
Absolutely.
Knock it down.
That struck me. It's one thing to fight the president on building the wall, doing what he wants to do, building vast new stretches of new wall on the border. it's another thing to say that you want to tear down a wall that is already there and a wall that went up, part of it under Barack Obama, part of it under George W. Bush, part of it before both of them. Mm-hmm. What is that something that's going to catch on? Is that where the Democrats are going to go? Not simply don't build the wall, but tear down the wall that's already there?
That felt extreme to me. And I wonder if the congressman, should he decide to run, would have to start walking that phrase back pretty fast. The former congressman, I should say. But I'm reminded of when Nancy Pelosi called the idea of a wall immoral. That sent a lot of shockwaves through the Democratic Party. And you even saw some Democrats really push back on that idea. They said, no, we're for border security. We don't think a wall is some existential issue, but we think it's not practical. It's not the best use of money. And the president is trying to subvert Congress to get this money for a pet project. Those are two really different arguments, like you laid out. Beto here seems to be in line with Nancy Pelosi, saying that he believes there's a fundamental issue with anything on the border. And my follow-up to him would have been, does that mean that nothing should be done? Are you in favor of open borders? That's a quick rabbit hole.
And I thought it was interesting. And you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I haven't heard a lot from the other 2020 candidates on this. I'm sure they'll all now get variations of this question in the coming days and weeks, months. But I do know somebody who was paying very close attention and who caught this and who talked about it. And he's a guy. Well, take a listen.
First of all, they won't do it because they know it's wrong. They know walls are necessary, maybe more than we do. But they're playing a political game. And their new game is let's take down all walls. I saw where Beto wanted to take down walls. I said, they asked me, what do you think? I said, well, I think that's probably the end of his political career.
So I do know, and, you know, politics can be unpredictable, but I think that that those in Trump political circles were thrilled with that exchange and would mm-hmm. like to see other Democrats jump on board because they think that is something that they can fight against. They may have a hard time convincing the country to spend billions of taxpayer dollars to build something that the president had said that Mexico would pay for. But to portray the other side as somebody that wants to essentially truly have open borders and take down any barriers that currently exist, that is something that they relish.
Yeah. The president and the White House has wanted to fight out all politics in this arena. They've wanted to make it about immigration, about protecting an American worker, America first, being tough on crime, tough on the border. They want the conversation in this space. When you said that not a lot of 2020ers have weighed in on those comments so far, that's because Democrats are trying to fight this coming 2020 battle out on a different space. They want to talk about health care and jobs and minimum wage and climate change. And so part of this is going to be who can win the narrative and who can decide which conversation we're all having. I was struck, though, by President Trump saying that this was probably the end of his political career. I think that the president knows just as well as anyone that very rarely does one line and one controversial line make the end of a political career, especially for him.
Especially. So we have to take a quick break, Mary Alice, but we're going to come back. We've got a guest lined up, friend of the president's, and somebody who I think maybe broke a really big story this week about the president's thinking about a key player on his national security team. We'll be back in just a moment.
Is it still a struggle to get that good night's sleep? Then maybe it's time to try the Purple mattress. It's made out of a new material that keeps it firm and soft, so it keeps everything supported while still feeling really comfortable. Try it now with a 100-night risk-free trial, along with free shipping and returns. And if you order one, you'll get a free purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. Just text POWERHOUSE to 474747. The only way to get this free pillow is to text POWERHOUSE to 474747. Message and data rates may apply.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Get started today at Indeed.com/powerhouse. That's Indeed.com/powerhouse.
Hello, and welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. We are joined now by Media mogul Chris Ruddy of Newsmax, somebody who also happens to be a longtime friend of a guy named Donald Trump. Chris, how are you?
John, I'm good, but usually not described as a media mogul. But
come on.
Website owner and fledgling TV channel. We're taking on ABC with Newsmax TV. Go watch us. We can still watch you on the evening news.
All right, good. Hey, so I got to say, you made some comments a few days ago that it got some attention. You suggested in an interview on another network that the president was losing faith in his director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, the top intelligence official on his national security team, created a little bit of a stir. And you said that this is something that you had understood that the president had been talking to others about, right?
Correct.
I got to say, I looked at my newspaper this morning and the Washington Post front page, and suddenly I see this story. President Trump has grown increasingly disenchanted with Director of National Security Daniel Coats, leading some administration officials to worry he will soon be dismissed. I mean, it doesn't cite you in this, but I think you kind of opened the door to this. You kind of broke this story. So how real is this?
Well, I think the Washington Post corroborated what I said, word for word, almost. Look, the president didn't tell me. I don't need to speak to him directly on this. I did see him several times over the weekend, and I do speak to him, as you know, from time to time. He doesn't need me to go and talk about his personnel changes, right? Even though I have been a friend of his and we do talk about various things, I talk to a lot of people in the administration. I've known them, many of them, even before I knew President Trump, when he was a civilian businessman living here in Palm Beach, New York. And from time to time, I'll mention things I'm hearing about people in the administration, or I'll give my opinion on them. And it was just my view when I was asked on CNN with Christiane Amanpour about the North Korea summit and the intelligence chiefs like Dan Coats, who's director of national intelligence, that he gave testimony that contradicted the president's assessments on that. And I said that I had heard from a number of people in the White House and in the national security parts of the administration the president was very displeased by him and that there might be a change of leadership there at the DNI. And I think the Washington Post supported that, and I stand by what I said. And, you know, whether the president's going to fire him or not, that's the president's decision. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. But I do think there's a view that maybe he's overstayed his welcome there in that job.
I'll tell you, the reactions to that particular change, if the president makes it, I think would be strong. Coats has got a former senator, of course, from Indiana, somebody who has a lot of support among Republicans on Capitol Hill, and is somebody who's seen as, I mean, we overuse this way of describing people, as one of the real adults in the administration, widely respected, and et cetera, et cetera. It would be really something to see the president make a change while he's involved in these negotiations with North Korea, which is one of the top, maybe the top, one of the top intelligence challenges facing this administration. But as you point out, Coats has contradicted the president on this. I mean, Coats has said point blank that he doesn't think that North Korea is going to give up its nuclear weapons, and the president is about to go to Vietnam to have a summit with Kim Jong-un where the aim of the summit is to get him to give up his nuclear weapons.
You know, that's not what's going to happen in the future is not a matter of classified intelligence. It's a prediction of what some governmental official. I would argue that Dan Coats is good, but I would say he's not an expert. He's not a guy that comes out of the intelligence field. He was involved in oversight. There's a big difference. I think, John, there's a lot of people that could take that job that would be very experienced, very vigorous, advocate for the president's policies, but also give him information that helps him inform his decisions. I think undercutting the president just a couple of weeks before he's going on a very important summit, saying it's not going to succeed, this is not particularly helpful. I don't think it was necessary in open session. If he wanted to make those comments in closed sessions, I think probably would have been fine. You know, the president's very open. I've known the guy for many years. You've known him. You covered him as a reporter long before he became president. He's open to criticism. I've criticized him publicly, privately, and we're still friends. He still takes my phone calls. I take his. What I don't think he likes is if you're on his staff, if you're a member of his cabinet, and you're openly criticizing him or suggesting what he's doing is wrong. And there's been, I think, several incidents with Coates that the president just decided, you know what, I think that this is what I'm hearing, that maybe it's time for a change. But that'll be ultimately his decision. You know, a few times through the 2 years of administrations, I've weighed in where I made a prediction about something. I said there was a lot of weakness with Ryan DePriebus and that he was eventually going to go, and took a few months longer than I thought, but it happened. And
your track record's pretty good on this stuff, man. Your track record's pretty good. I think the ruddy crystal ball's been pretty accurate.
I know. That's why I keep saying I want to go to Vegas with you and Mary Alice. So,
but is this just a matter of the president being the kind of leader that eventually gets frustrated with everyone?
Well, I think if you look across the administration, that hasn't been true. I think that...
Really? Turnover's been record high.
It's been record high, but it's not far off from, like, the Clinton first 2 years and the Clinton administration in terms of percentages. Looking back at Donald Trump's private businesses, I would say the turnover was very low. He had very high retention. His staff and people that work for him are very loyal people with him for years. I think what happened, Mary Alice, is he went into politics. He didn't know any of the players. The way he does things, he doesn't really prep for things. He doesn't strategize on things. He does things a little more trial and error, and just hits the ground running and lets things happen and tests people out. And that works okay in private business over a period of time. I think in government, it gives a sense of discontinuity, and that's why some people are concerned. But if you look across the cabinet, I see a lot of stability as well. Mnuchin's been there. Wilbur Ross has been there. Ben Carson.
But there are five agency heads where there's currently someone just serving in a temporary acting role. And, I mean, that's a lot. And so when you look at that, I wonder, could he really afford to lose someone else right now? Would that just be too much instability?
Well, let's go through. I mean, a lot of these agencies do run. They don't need to have somebody. They have a lot of sub-agency people that are running. The Attorney General, he picked a great, experienced Attorney General. I don't think anyone, even the Democrats, confirmed him pretty much without a hiccup, Attorney General Barr. And then I think Stranahan's going to stay. I think the president's very comfortable with him, and I could see him staying. And so that'll probably become, my guess, is a permanent position. So you're getting most of those major positions filled.
What's your sense? You're obviously you're a member down there at Mar-a-Lago, and you spend time with the president when he goes down there. But he hasn't been down there a lot this year. The shutdown really kind of got in the way of his typical winter travel. What was your sense seeing him down there? What's his mood? What's his level of contentment or discontentment with his current White House team under Mulvaney?
I think he was in great mood. He was great form and very relaxed. I think it is part of the environment for him. He really loves being down in Florida. He loves seeing friends and family and associates he's known for a long time. It's a place for him to chill, exercise, relax, get out, get fresh air, and be in an environment that's not so hostile. Washington is not a place, I would say, that is friendly to people like Donald Trump. And so I think it's good for him, too, because when he gets these perspectives, he goes back with a fresh look on things. So he seemed, and you're right, he's been missing a lot of weekends here because of the shutdown and other factors, and he's off now to Korea. So he usually, in the past, I believe he spent the whole week here during President's Week, and he cut that short. But I think it's fun. You know, if you look back at the Reagan years, they counted up the days Reagan sent out of Rancho Cielo and near Santa Barbara at his ranch, and it turned out it was a whole year of his presidency he spent out there. But I think everybody looks back and said Reagan was a great president. So it's not really the amount of time, it's the quality of the time, and I think Donald Trump realizes that.
Okay, I want to switch gears here to my bread and butter, election politics. There are now a dozen Democrats who are basically in the race already against him. Are there any of those candidates that you've heard he's more worried about, that makes him more nervous?
No, I haven't heard that he's worried about any of them. I think some of them he finds a little comical, like Elizabeth Warren. And I don't think he really thinks there's anyone serious that is going to really defeat him. I think he's very confident in his reelection. And I think the Democrats, they're sort of becoming a circus. And I think that plays into the president's strength, which is he's a person of strength. I was chatting with him this weekend about the Quinnipiac poll. There was a poll last year. They asked Americans what his strongest attribute was, and 63% of Americans said he was strong, which is a pretty big number when you consider how much criticism he gets. So a lot of people like that he's strong, even though they might not agree with him on many issues, on some issues. And then when you see so much disorientation coming out of the Democratic Party, I think it'll redound into his strength. And I think voters pause about voting for the Democrat. And I think that may be a reason he's confident.
Well, of course, he's going to have to get by Bill Weld before he gets a chance to run against the Democrat there, Chris.
He's worried. I'm sure Donald Trump's worried about Bill Weld.
I'm sure it's going to be, it is going to be one hell of a brutal race one way or the other. We will have a chance to check in with you along the way. Chris Ruddy, thank you for joining us on Powerhouse Politics, and we'll talk to you again soon.
John and Mary Alice, great being on with you. Look forward to it again. Bye.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, Mary Alice, but before we sign off here, I had a question for you because I've been wondering, and I know you have the answer, because we were talking about all the, you know, the dozen candidates that have gotten in. Is Joe Biden going to run?
Oh, man, I talk about making money in Vegas with you. I mean, it's the chit-chat all around Washington right now. But all of our sources say it is pointing more and more in that direction. I am now at the point where I would be surprised if he did not.
Wait a minute. Let me just – so you would be surprised if Joe Biden does not run. So you think he is in this thing?
Right now, I think the sources close to him say it's looking more and more likely. It seems like the momentum is that in that direction. I got to say, though – Bernie Sanders putting up those monster fundraising numbers overnight, $6 million in 24 hours. It is possible that even something like that is intimidating to even a former vice president.
Wow. Well, my sense that Ruddy wouldn't really answer the question, but my sense among the president's political advisors is that Biden is somebody that they do fear. I think that that they should fear whoever's going to get the Democratic nomination. This is going to be a tough race, no matter what.
Yeah, that would make sense, though.
But that's the name that I get the sense that that gives them the most concerns. Although, a subject for another podcast, I think that Biden's going to have a tough time in this field. So we will see.
Do
you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
Okay. All right. That is all the time we have for Powerhouse Politics. Mary Alice Parks for the wherever the hell he is, Rick Klein, Trevor Hastings, our senior chief executive producer, Avery Miller, Angie Yak, and the entire Powerhouse Politics team. Thank you for listening.